I think we'll be talking to Zafar. Has he joined us?
Yes. Hello,
there?
Phil.
Oh, how are you?
Hello, Phil. I'm on the line with you. Yes.
Great. Wonderful. This is Zafar Ben-Gersh, a scholar and a brilliant political analyst. By the way, Zafar, people can follow you, right? I mean, you have you do regular. I'll let you tell us. But
yes,
people can follow you.
Yes, of course. I've got several things going simultaneously. I have I put up videos on the internet, short clips about 4 or 5 minutes long regarding latest developments, and these revolve around Syria, the Middle East region, and other places, or any developing stories. And I also have a Substack account where I put stories up, but perhaps the video clips, they just have to Google my name, and they'll be able to find all of these videos on YouTube.
Isn't that wonderful? Thank you for telling us. I urge people to follow Zafar, because I should say, Zafar, that there are matters we want to get into. One thing I appreciate about the fact that you're available to readers and listeners through these sites, one of our problems, I believe, is that on this matter of Gaza, Syria, and the kind of crisis unfolding there, is that there tends to be, particularly amongst people who are opposed to colonialism and opposed to imperialism and stand for the old doctrine of the right to self-determination of peoples and all that, that there's only one or two voices that everyone seems to be going to. And the anti-colonial movement has many, many voices. And, for example, you're one, and we've spoken to Atif Kaboursi on his show. There are many very qualified people who are not being tapped into, that people are sort of falling into one person to each country spokesperson. Have you noticed that?
Yes, of course. And I think it seems to be deliberate, because there is a certain narrative that is being pushed forward. So, for instance, if you look at the current situation in Syria, many commentators are referring to it as a revolution. I find it so difficult to accept that designation, because the revolutions are carried out.
No, there are words, to the better word, counter-revolution.
Yes. Yes. This is basically a coup which was engineered by the U.S., Israel, and Turkey, and financed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And if we pay careful attention to video footage that has emerged from Syria since December the 8th, any quote-unquote celebrations that have been shown in Damascus, for instance, the number of people is so small that it's laughable. That means that the vast majority of the Syrian people are not behind this change. Mm-hmm. I do not necessarily want to say that they were in favor of the previous government, but they certainly do not want to hand over their country to people that have a very, very dubious past. These people had set up their government in Idlib province in northwest of Syria. And there, according to journalists that were quite sympathetic to them, who were on the ground, they said that these people executed opponents. They ran prisons where they tortured people. They deprived food of people that they thought were opposed to them. They basically had slave girls that they sexually molested.
Yes.
And that is a horrible, horrible record of people. And regrettably, using the name of Islam, they deliberately set out to tarnish the message of Islam by putting that label on themselves.
Yeah.
But I know that was deliberate, because,
By the way, I want to ask you about that. I mean, and of course, today I would plan to focus on Kotler, but I have to say, and I know you're a veteran of all this, and your analysis began way back on this subject of false people operating under the name of Islam, but behaving totally at odds with the principles of Islam. And I think I would just ask you this. I recall that when the United States was enthusiastic previously about an Islamic movement, the one that operated in Afghanistan and one that Dan Rather and all the others, you know, put on their costumes to pretend that they were like Pakistani locals so that they could crawl around in the mountains with these so-called freedom fighters. One of the things that was lost there because they was that they kept saying, oh, they're fighting the Russians. But they were also very vocal about being against the Islamic revolution of Iran.
Yes.
They were extremely hostile.
That sort of, you know, explains exactly what was taking place at that time. And incidentally, the same people that the Americans were supporting at that time, then as soon as the Soviet army was withdrawn from Afghanistan, then America immediately turned against them and said that these people are now terrorists. And
yes, we know they went from being George Washington to being criminals.
Exactly. In fact, you know, in 1983, these Afghan, you know, leaders were invited to the White House. And Reagan compared them to the founding fathers of America.
Indeed.
These are his exact words. He invited them to the White House, gave them, you know, lavish reception, and said that these are like the founding fathers of America, and they are freedom fighters, and we need to support them.
Yes.
And the same freedom fighters, after the Soviet army was withdrawn, then they became terrorists. And America sent its army into Afghanistan, and it waged a 20-year war. And on August 21st, 2021, the Taliban once again took over Afghanistan. And somebody had made a very, very, you know, extremely good comment about this. It was actually Normal Finkelstein, who said that if you are feeling depressed, consider this, that America spent $1.26 trillion over a 20-year period to first overthrow the Taliban and put the Taliban back in power. So, you know, we can see what has taken place over
and
there.
And you notice that the permanent one is the U.S.
Yes,
they play this, and I don't know why we have to always repeat that divide and conquer is the name of the game. From the maybe it's because people get bored saying it, but it happens to be very true. The other point I would just want to underline there is that the Islamic Revolution really did shake the world. The Islamic Revolution of Iran, and it reminded me of the notion that firefighters have that they set a fire to put out a fire. And they invested heavily in these, they called them Islamic leaders, but whose goal was to defeat the Islamic Revolution.
Yes. Now, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, of course, was the revolution in the Muslim world that was not dependent either on the U.S. or the Soviet Union. Of course, there was a Soviet Union at the time. It was a entirely indigenous, independent revolution, and they have maintained their independence at enormous cost, and they have continued to support people, oppressed people all over the world, not just in the Muslim world, but all over the world.
Yes.
You know, you can look at the examples of Nicaragua, you can look at
Venezuela, Cuba.
Venezuela, Cuba. They have maintained excellent relations with them. And in fact, in the case of Venezuela, when the U.S. imposed sanctions, it was Iran that defied American sanctions and sent, you know, refined fuel to the Venezuelans to make sure that their factories and the country functions. So that's the kind of help they have extended to all oppressed people, all people that are facing U.S. Western imperialism. And the same, of course, the same principle applies in terms of Iran's support for the Palestinian people or the people of Lebanon or Yemen who are fighting these aggressors that are constantly attacking the civilians as well as their infrastructure and their hospitals and other life-saving facilities. So we see that Iran's record has been absolutely consistent in terms of supporting the oppressed people.
Yes. But now, again, we're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and you can't go. You can find Zafar Benghash. All you have to do is enter his name, and you will get opportunity to read and follow his writings and comments, commentary. There's a country here that I've, last week we were speaking to you, and I really wanted to make sure we got you back and to talk further about this, and that is Qatar. They play an outsized role, it strikes me. I mean, it's so amazing to me that they, it's a country with not quite 3 million people, I think, but only 300,000 of them are actually Qatari, and only one quarter of the population is women, and they were the family that seems to be running. Of course, you know more about this, obviously, is that the Al-Thani family have been there since the British East India Company.
Yes.
And they keep showing up every time there's a, like they say, there's going to be peace talks. They have to be at the meeting. Why do they have to be at the meeting?
Well, basically, Qatar acts as a front for the United States. So, for instance, it was the U.S. that encouraged or permitted, actually, Qatar to allow a Taliban office in their capital city, Doha. So this was established in 2018 because the Americans were now tiring of the war in Afghanistan. So that way, it enabled U.S. diplomats to have discussions with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar. And, of course, it culminated in the agreement in 2020. And then the Americans fled in August of 2021. Also, the Qataris have, you know, if you recall, in July of 2017, Saudi Arabia imposed sanctions on Qatar. And the reason was, in fact, the Saudi ruler, the new de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince, is an arrogant person, not particularly bright. And he thought Qatar can be brought to its knees. And his demands were that Qatar should shut down Al Jazeera, its television network. It should expel Turkish forces that were over there. It should cut off all relations with Iran and a whole lot of other, you know, conditions, about 10 of them. Immediately, Iran offered to help Qatar to overcome these sanctions because Iran felt that these were unfair. Iran itself has been under sanctions for decades. The U.S., the Western world have imposed these illegal sanctions on Iran. So it knows what devastation it can cause. And Iran also facilitated Turkish goods to be flown to Qatar via Iran's ports. Now, look at this, the irony of this, that the same Qataris that were actually saved from collapse then stabbed Iran in the back by you know, doing what they did in Syria. They financed these terrorists that were based in Idlib, and they conspired with the Americans, the Israelis, and the Turks to bribe the Syrian army, particularly the commanders. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we have to admit that there was a weakness in the Syrian structure, state structure, that and there was a reason for it, because Syria's oil fields as well as most productive agricultural land is in the northeast, which is under Kurdish and an American control.
Mm-hmm.
And so the oil that is produced over there was and is being smuggled from there to Turkey, and from Turkey it is sent to Israel. Can you imagine that, that is how this dirty game is being played by the Turks and yes. the Americans. And
it is so. It's so striking. By the way, you what you're pointing out there, it is. It's known for anyone wishes to know it, but no one talks about it.
Correct. I mean, and also, end of last month, the Americans, the Pentagon, finally admitted that they had 2,000 troops in northeast Syria illegally, of course. Mm. Previously, they were insisting that it was only 900. I'm amazed as to how any military officer who is in charge of these affairs can maintain that kind of a falsehood. Because anybody who has served in the military would know how many men or women are under their command, because they have to come out for morning drill. They have to be allocated budget for food and all other kinds of facilities. There's almost
yes.
2.5 times the difference between 900 and 2,000.
Yes.
And yet they maintain this fiction. I think the chief of CENTCOM must be fired for peddling this falsehood, because either he couldn't do his math properly or he was lying.
Yes.
But even an ordinary person can figure that out. But I think there is a reason behind why the U.S. has now admitted that they have 2,000 troops there, because essentially they are sending this message to Turkey that if you mess around with the Kurds, because those are the ones that America and Israel are using to destabilize the region, because Kurds exist not only in Syria, they exist in Turkey, in Iraq, and in Iran. So they are dangling this carrot before the Kurds that in the not too distant future, they will create a separate state for them. And that will essentially destabilize and break up 4 different countries. And that obviously is something that Israel wants, that's something that the U.S. wants, because the more countries are disintegrated, as Syria is today, then that benefits Israel, because Israel becomes the dominant power.
Of course. I mean, Syria doesn't have anything anymore. They blew up the Navy, they blew up the Air Force, they blew up all the supplies. And so Israel doesn't care if they kill each other with partisan warfare for 3 or 4 years, because they will be able to dominate. They'll go back to the lawn mowing concept. Occasionally they will just go and blow up what they feel like.
Correct. As you rightly pointed out, Syria has been not only demilitarized, it has been militarily neutered now. Syria has no military assets left. And it is very revealing that the new so-called rulers have not uttered a single word of protest, much less condemnation of what Israel is doing and has done in Syria. Israel has also occupied large parts of Syrian territory in the south. Syrian tanks are now poised 25 kilometers outside Damascus, and they can drive into Damascus anytime they want. They've also taken over Mount Hermon, which is the highest peak overlooking Damascus. So from there, it is all downhill to Damascus. Yes. And 2-3 days ago, the Israelis also occupied 6 water facilities just outside Damascus. So now they control large parts of Syria's land as well as water resources in the south. And if they were to shut off those water resources, they could literally, people would die of thirst, because there'll be no water in their homes.
Yes.
So these are the kinds of activities and steps that Israel has taken, And yet the new rulers that have been installed in Damascus have not said anything about it. They go about, they're running around, they've been to Saudi Arabia, they went there last week, then they have gone to Qatar. They need to have asking them for investment so that they can rebuild Syria. These are the same countries that had basically blocked all help to Syria in the past, and they were essentially, you know, America had blockaded Syria. It had caused great suffering to the Syrian people. And the reason was that they wanted to bring down the government in Syria so that Syria could be taken out of the resistance axis equation. Syria was never directly involved. It was simply used as a sort of a conduit to supply help to Hezbollah. That has been, of course, disrupted. But there will be other ways that Iran would be able to help Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is also able to produce its own weapons. So it's not completely, shut off. And within Syria... go ahead.
And also they have disarmed all Palestinians. And they say they cannot be there as political entities any longer. They have to be refugees only.
Yes. So essentially what they are saying then, they have repeatedly, the new rulers have repeatedly said that they want to live in peace with Israel. They don't have any, they won't allow anybody to attack Israel from Syria. Although nobody has ever attacked Israel from Syria. I mean, even the previous government did not allow that.
Of course,
Their treatment of the Palestinians is atrocious, that they have disarmed them. They've told them that you can have no political activities. You can only live, as you said, only live as refugees. Now, that's the kind of, clear indication that these people are puppets of Israel as well as the United States.
If they want good relations with Israel, that means they have to become their obedient servant. They have to be a vassal, because Israel will tell them what it wants. And if they don't give them what they want, they probably won't be there long. But I want to ask or mention one other thing about this matter of Qatar. People should be reminded, should they not, that Qatar was a leading element in the so-called Arab world to bring down Libya, Gaddafi in Libya. They also were a lead element in bringing down Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and now they another scalp, I guess, has been added with Syria. But they played a leading role in all those.
Yes, it's a small country, but because it has enormous wealth, and as a consequence of that, they have always allowed themselves to be used by the Americans. So if you look at Qatar's example, when Saddam Hussein was fighting against Iran from September 1980 to August 1988, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, all of these Arab states supplied troops and their money to try to bring down Iran's Islamic government. When that failed, then and America assembled an army of half a million in Saudi Arabia on the borders with Iraq. Again, these same Arab regimes, including Qatar, were there to bring down, Saddam Hussein's regime. Yeah. Then, as you mentioned, in Libya, they played the same dirty role. They supplied Air Force planes. Qatar provided F-16 planes.
Bahrain did. I have a memory that the first aerial attack, the first plane was flown. They went to great pains. It was like a designer hit. They had a female pilot from Qatar who was the first to drop a bomb on Tripoli, I think it was.
Yes, and you can see that Libya, which was the most prosperous country in the whole of Africa, was bombed into the Stone Age, and Gaddafi was lynched. And now we have Libya in total shambles. a lot of the terrorists erupted from there. They went into Syria. They also went into Iraq at the time. And they caused a lot of death and destruction. And we can see the consequences of that now in Syria as well. So as you pointed out, Qatar has been a consistent player in advancing Zionist imperialist agenda in the region, even though it's a tiny country. And I think a time will come, I see, that you know Qatar will pay a very heavy price for this. They're very, very vulnerable. All it will take is just one missile.
It's so unreal, you know, that they have, there are, probably that explains why there are 10,000 U.S. troops in Qatar, and it's a command center, because there are two-thirds of the population are not Qataris, and they do all the work.
Yes.
What a...
And you know, prior to the World Cup in 2022, there were reports that, you know, the Qataris were actually exploiting these foreign workers, keeping them in horrible conditions. And that came out for a little while, but of course, you know, since Qatar is a Western puppet, so all of these things were forgotten. Mm-hmm. You know, Qatar's Amir was, you know, received in Britain just a few weeks ago, and they were received in Buckingham Palace. King Charles welcomed them. There was a state dinner, you know. And imagine a country, as you said, the total population of 300,000 is being welcomed by the British monarch for a, you know, a royal banquet in Buckingham Palace. So that indicates that they are their stooges, that they carry out yes. Western agenda, and yeah. Britain also exercises considerable control over Qatar.
Yeah, and doesn't it underline, I mean, it strikes me that one of the things we have to learn from the Syria experience is that the determination on the side of the colonialist slash neo-colonialist is to control that area, and they're not going away just because somebody fires a shot at them. They're going to stay until there is a serious popular movement.
And my you know, information is that that popular movement is emerging in Syria, because the vast majority of the Syrian people are very unhappy with what has happened in their country. They simply do not want to see hand over their country to the Zionists and the imperialists. And I think we should not be surprised if this movement were to emerge within the next few weeks. We'll have to see. But I clearly see the signs of that. And there are stirrings of that kind of an
yes.
uprising.
It's not just going to be an issue of the Kurds. This is the Syrian people.
Yes. And the Syrian people, I must add, are very, very proud people. They are sort of, you know, educated, they are determined, and they will not allow their country to be taken over by the Zionists and imperialists. And tragically, this is the first time in its entire history. And Syria has a very, very long history. It's like, you know, even it has a very long history, positive history of Christianity as well. Christianity mm-hmm. has a very strong presence there, that Syria has always been an independent country. And this is the first time in its history that it has been disintegrated, it has been cut into pieces and occupied by various foreign powers. But I do not think that that is a permanent you know, feature of Syria's future, because the Syrian people will not tolerate it.
Isn't Damascus the oldest occupied city in civilization? One
yes,
of them?
I think Damascus is definitely, it's a very, very old city. In fact, Syria has a lot of history. I mean, Aleppo itself has a lot of, that's the second largest city in Syria. Damascus is definitely, you know, the oldest capital city that is now under occupation, yes.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story. Zafar Bengash, please, everyone follow his writings and talks. Thank you very much, Zafar.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto. And I want to thank Pedro for the great work. And we're lucky to have a guest like Zafar. And I want to underline, you better spread out your sources of information. It seems to me that too many people who are purport to be pundits, etc., are all going to the same door, eight pundits and one guy that they talk to. We need a broader discussion. Again, for the Taylor Report, see you next week.